We push, we reach, we rise, we rise, we rise, we rise. Hand in hand we stand as one. We push, we reach, we rise, sister of my tears.
Good Monday morning. You are tuned to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. The song you just heard was We Rise by Rihanna Giddens. We're in the middle of Women's History Month, and today on The Mole, we've got a couple of segments about the lives of women. But before we get started, I'd like to remind you that we are also in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills Winter Drive. We only have a few days left to reach our $17,000 goal. So if you can, please support your community-powered radio station. You can go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. You can text KBOO to 44321, or if you are using the KBOO mobile app, just click on the donate button you find there. Remember, the Old Mole is on the air because of support by listeners like you. Today on our show, Fran Michelle explains how attempts to maintain gender oppression and the ideal of the bourgeois nuclear family are part of neoliberal attacks on the public sphere and workers' empowerment. We'll close our show with our Left and the Law segment. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker take stock of recent legal challenges to the immunity historically granted to the makers of guns. To open our show, Laurie Mercier speaks with Indigenous artist Nayana Lafond, who has made it her mission to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous people, who are overwhelmingly women, and to honor the memory of lost ones. Her striking portraits of those lost have brought a measure of healing and hope to bereaved families. Lafond's Portraits in Red, Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Painting Project is showing now through May 7 at the Pacific Maritime Heritage Center in Newport, Oregon. You should check it out. Lafond will also be speaking at Washington State University, Vancouver, Tuesday, March 21st at 3 p.m. in the Multimedia Classroom Building, Room 16. Here's Laurie with Nayana Lafond.
Good morning. With me from Massachusetts is Indigenous artist and domestic violence survivor Nayana Lafond, who has created a powerful exhibit, Portraits in Red, currently showing at the Pacific Maritime Heritage Center in Newport. She is an accomplished artist and curator, and her paintings and sculptures can be found in galleries, museums, and private collections around the world. She's the former founding chief curator for the Whitney Center for the Arts and sits on several arts organization boards, including Artist Organized Art, and is an advisor for Be the Change and the Native Youth Empowerment Foundation. As an act of remembrance and healing, Lafond created an ongoing series of more than 100 portraits she has painted of missing and murdered Indigenous people and their loved ones. She'll be talking about the project on Tuesday, March 21st at Washington State University, Vancouver. Welcome to KBOO, Nayana Lafond, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You began painting images of missing and murdered Indigenous people in 2020 during the COVID pandemic. Could you tell us about the origins of the project?
Sure. It's sort of started unwittingly, and I never thought it would become a project. All of the work I create on in any medium always goes back to processing my own trauma in some way and just trying to seek out healing through art. So this project started the same way. I was on a group on Facebook called Social Distance Powwow and quarantined like everyone else was. And I saw a post, but if I can rewind, it was May 5th of 2020, which is the Day of Remembrance for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People. So I was on the group and everyone was posting about that, about their experiences, sharing selfies, things like that. And I saw a post by a woman from Saskatchewan named Lorena Bear. And her image was just very striking from an artistic standpoint. So I reached out to her and asked, could I paint your image as my contribution for remembrance for this day? And she accepted, and I did so and shared it back to the group a few days later. And the response was so overwhelming. I had over 2,000 reactions overnight. Those were likes and comments and things. So the next day I said, well, you know, I'm still stuck at home with nothing to do. I'll paint one more, thinking that would be it. And reached out to a mother and daughter, a pair named Netahne and Yana, and they agreed. And I painted them, and the response was over 3,000. And just to give some context, now I have a TikTok video that has 1.4 million views on it. So it is snowballed in a way I never anticipated. But it was shortly after that that I said, well, I'm still bored at home, so I'll paint anyone who sends me their image. And I put one post to this day. It's still only one, which I later took down because it got a little overwhelming. But I put one post up saying, you know, I'll paint anyone who sends to me. I'll do it for free. This is just something for me to do. And in the first day, I received over 25 with stories and images. And it was in that moment that I started to see the connections between my own life experiences, that of my mother and my grandmother and so on, and all of these families. And I knew I had to paint all of them. And I even at that point, I thought, oh, this will be it. You know, it'll slow down and I'll paint as many as come in and that will be it. But it hasn't slowed down. So that's when I figured out I had to set parameters, make it a project, set rules for myself, and make it definable with a purpose.
I'm sure that as gratifying as it is to be reaching so many thousands or millions of people with your art and informing people more broadly about this issue, that it is traumatizing or difficult. So I can understand the kinds of parameters that you might set for yourself. How long do you envision this project continuing?
Well, through the whole thing, I've kind of been feeling it out and letting it inform me what it needs from me. And at this point, I've made the perhaps somewhat unwitting dedication to paint all of them, and they keep coming. So I don't know that there's an end in sight, unfortunately. I would much rather be making work about a much happier subject. It is very re-traumatizing every time, but it's also healing. And it's given me a sense of purpose.
How have the families of the victims that you've painted reacted?
It's been a mixed bag of emotions, overwhelmingly positive. However, it's difficult. It's difficult to see your loved one, or in some instances yourself, if you're a survivor, painted in this way with the red hand and the symbolism that comes with that. But several have come to me and said that they also feel like their loved one's voice is now able to be heard, or that they're able to grieve in a different way than they were before, or something like that. And that has helped me keep going, because people are saying they're getting something positive out of it.
Well, let's talk a bit about the more than 9,500 Indigenous people, mostly women, girls, Two-Spirit people, who have been reported missing nationwide last year, according to the FBI's National Crime Information Center. And the fact that Indigenous women and girls are murdered at 10 times the rate of other ethnicities. And a majority of these murders are committed by non-Native people on Native-owned land. So what are the reasons for this astonishingly and horrible high rate of murders and missing people?
Well, I wish I could say there's one reason or even two reasons, because that would make dealing with this issue easier. But there's so many different reasons. It goes back to concepts around colonization, around coming in and taking over a group of people. And when you do so, you have to go for the heart of the people. And when it's a matriarchal society, you go for the women. So this started in the very beginning. There were letters written back home from men who were here saying, oh, I keep one or two Indigenous women under my bed for my personal use. And it started then, and it's just snowballed from there through over-sexualization and fetishization, I can never say that word properly, of Indigenous women and girls, and has gone into realms related to human trafficking and the Indigenous population being targeted for that, because there is only a 6% prosecution rate on these cases. People aren't looking for these people. So it's become that we're a vulnerable population, and that's known. On top of that, there's issues related to man camps for things like extractive industries. There are issues related to intergenerational trauma and domestic abuse. When 3 out of 4 Indigenous women experience abuse from their intimate partner, that says something. So all of these things kind of weave together to create this story and this truth that is unfortunately affecting every single Indigenous family.
And from what I understand, the rates of missing and murdered Indigenous women increased with the development of these man camps in these extractive industries in both Canada and the United States. And Canada had launched a national inquiry and officially acknowledged race-based genocide against Indigenous people there. What is happening in the United States to address this violence?
Not enough. And I can say that the same for Canada. It's not enough, but at least it's being talked about now. The president declared May 5th Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Day in 2021. That is definitely a lip service move, but at least it puts it into people's mouths to talk about. There are several pieces of legislation that I don't have in front of me at this moment, but there are several things on the books right now. There are people actively trying to find solutions to problems related to jurisdictional issues, but there's so many things that need to change that it can't just be one area or another. We have to kind of address it from a lot of different perspectives.
This is Laurie Mercier with the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, Portland, speaking with artist Nayana LaFond, whose exhibit Portraits in Red is currently showing at the Pacific Maritime Heritage Center in Newport. Nayana, could you tell us something about the 40 portraits that are displayed at the Heritage Center in Newport?
Sure. They are 40 out of 109 I've completed so far. I sent out as many people who were from the Pacific Northwest as I had available that I had painted. So there are several people who are actively missing from Oregon and Washington and Northern California. And unfortunately, some who are no longer with us. The rest of the people are from all over Turtle Island, North America. So there's people from Canada, there's people from the US, and from people who are from reservations and cities. So it's a really diverse group, and I think it's important to show that. There's also some activists mixed in there, which I think is important. I chose to include activists in this because I feel as though these images can very quickly just turn into traumatic experiences for those viewing it. And providing the activists gives people a sense of that they can make change as well, that there are people actively working to create change. So I'm hoping that that comes through also. But the group, each piece is a real person with a real story. And whenever I'm allowed, I share those stories.
And listeners can look at your website for some examples of these portraits, which are so compelling. Could you say more about why the portraits are in white and black and the significance of the blood red handprint that is usually painted on the mouth of each portrait or each person portrayed?
Absolutely. So putting the hand over the mouth is a symbol of going to war in a lot of different tribal belief systems. The red itself is about war, but it's also about the blood of our people. It's about death. It's about the missing. The symbol of the red hand over the mouth has become the universal symbol for the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples movement. So that's the language that translates well for this. But I chose to paint them in black and white, with only red being the visible color. So some of them will have a sweater that has red on it, and that still visibly is red, and things like that, because a lot of Indigenous people believe that spirits can only see the color red. So I paint them in this way because I want the spirit of the person who I've painted to be able to see their own portrait. So it's an act of medicine or healing for me, and a relationship that I'm trying to build with each portrait.
You have embraced the label artivist as an activist artist. How is activism central to your work, and how can art help organize for social justice?
Well, I think like many activists, I fell backwards into it and didn't choose it. And so when the title was presented to me, I felt it made sense, and it was certainly a lot easier than trying to smush things together. But I think that art has a way of humanizing topics that can be very difficult to digest. I think it's important to hear the statistics and to hear the hard facts about things, but it's easy to block those out and move on with our day. It's a lot more difficult when you have to look at the face of the person that you're talking about and their eyes look back at you. That's a lot more difficult to get past. So through art making as activism or artivism, it's an attempt to humanize these topics, to tap into our emotions and our feelings related to them, to promote change.
Do you have some other artivist projects at the moment in addition to portraits in red?
Yes, I have a sculpture that was on display in Boston outside of Fenway Park for summer and fall of 2020, and that was about domestic abuse. I build a metal witu, which is a wigwam, and on the inside, in over 20 different languages, I wrote things that said, I believe you, your children deserve to see you happy, you're worth saving, things that I needed to hear. And then on the outside were tiles with QR codes for shelters and human rights organizations and pro bono lawyers, all the resources I didn't have. So anytime that I've given an opportunity to do something like that, I tend to angle it towards some sort of activism thing, and it's almost involuntary. It just happens that way, that I need to express that or raise awareness about it or affect some sort of change. I'm the type of person who can't be silent.
And you recognize the power of art in communicating justice. Well, I encourage listeners to see Portraits in Red, Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Painting Project on display through May 7th at the Pacific Maritime Heritage Center in Newport, Oregon. And the public is invited to hear Nayana LaFond speak about the project on Tuesday, March 21st at Washington State University, Vancouver from 3 to 4:15 p.m. in the Multimedia Classroom Building, Room 16. For Native Americans and Alaska Natives to find culturally specific resources for domestic and sexual violence, please visit strongheartshelpline.org. Thank you so much, Nayana LaFon, for joining us today, and really look forward to hearing you speak on Tuesday and to see your exhibit in Newport. Thank you.
Chimigwech, merci.
Yes, sister, did you hear? Billy Rose ain't never been found. Went missing on the 4th of June. Family hasn't heard a sound. Jim Crow met her walking that knocked off Beach Road. Said she was meeting friends downtown, but then she never showed, and nobody knows. Hey, hey, where did she go? Hey, hey, someone has to know.
You just heard a clip from Pray, Sister, Pray by Crystal Shawanda. Before that, Laurie Mercier was speaking with Nayana LaFond. Check out her portraits of missing and murdered Indigenous people at the Pacific Maritime Heritage Center in Newport through May 7th. You are listening to KBOO Portland. If you like what you hear on The Old Mole, voices that you are not likely to hear on commercial radio, show your support by helping KBOO reach its $17,000 goal for our winter drive. All thrills, no frills. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Become a member today, and together we can keep KBOO going strong. Next up, our well-read Red, Fran Michelle, draws on various resources to argue how the escalating attacks on trans people are actually assaults on our collective responsibility to each other, and how those attacks maintain a status quo that absolves corporate America of any responsibility for the welfare of working people. Her commentary derives from the book Feminism for the 99% by Cynthia Arusa, Titi Bhattacharya, and Nancy Fraser. An article in The Tempest by Eric Maroney titled The Alt-Right Anti-Trans Crusades, and an article by Noah Zazanis in Spectre called Class Struggle for Abortion and Transition. Links to these resources are posted on the page for today's show at kboo.fm. Now, here's Fran.
Divided that come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heighten. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate.
You might have heard that a speaker at the Conservative Political Action Conference earlier this month called for the eradication of transgenderism, but said that doesn't mean he's calling for the elimination of transgender people. If we take him at his word about eradicating the category but not the people, maybe he wants to eliminate cis people. Transition for all! Yeah, you know, that's not what he meant. You may have heard that Tennessee legislators recently looked around at the collapsing climate and collapsing banks and exploding trains and raging pandemic and rising hunger and revival of child labor and decided that the important thing to do was ban drag shows? You will have noticed the recently escalating moral panic about trans people, including the enormous number of anti-LGBTQ bills floated in recent years, and particularly the number directed against trans people, hundreds of them, and the number of bills seems to grow every year. In Oregon, the ACLU has been tracking 7 such bills affecting healthcare and education. Clearly, these are forms of scapegoating. Measures that divide the working class, deflect attention from the dangers posed by the owning class, and help rally a distressed population in the service of a right-wing agenda. And clearly, they do not spring out of nowhere. Cultural and legislative campaigns are funded by think tanks and dark money, But the messages proliferate not only on alt-right websites and right-wing television, but also in mainstream venues like the New York Times, which in February received open letters from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation and from Times contributors, among others, protesting their persistent publication of biased, inaccurate, and dangerous stories. Not all of these attacks operate in the same ways or even from entirely the same motives, but they all contribute to a cumulative effect of making the world more dangerous for trans people and for all of us. Moreover, like attacks on abortion rights, attacks on trans rights and queer sociality aim to enforce the bourgeois family by any means necessary. As Noah Zazanis noted last year in Spectre magazine, while most children who experience sexual abuse are victimized by someone close to the family, the heterosexual family never faces groomer accusations. Grooming libel is not actually about sexual abuse, but instead targets trans and queer adults as sources of social contagion. Providing support and historical or cultural context for trans and queer youth is suspect precisely because it models possibilities outside of cisgender heterosexual expectations. As such, these attacks are a core tactic of right-wing organizing. But why do the bourgeois family and cisgender identity form so very natural and innate that they must be enforced through ideological propaganda and state legislation? Why do challenges to these forms generate such panic? In Feminism for the 99%, Cinzia Oruza, Tithi Bhattacharya, and Nancy Fraser argue that gender oppression in capitalist societies is rooted in the subordination of social reproduction to production for profit. Social reproduction is all the work of people making, not only all of the activity to create and sustain life in the biological sense, but also fashioning people with the right attitudes, dispositions, and values, abilities, competences, skills, appropriate for the continuation of the current society. Under capitalism, this work has been largely assigned to women, and when more advantaged workers outsource it, it's often to women of color, poor and immigrant workers, who usually also perform this labor, unpaid, for their own families. Social reproduction in capitalism is thus an issue of gender, but also one shot through at every point by the fault lines of class, race, sexuality, and nation. Back in 2006, the Beyond Marriage Statement pointed out that, quote, "The right has mounted a long-term strategic battle to dismantle all public service and benefit programs and civic values that were established beginning in the 1930s, initially as a response to widening poverty and the Great Depression. The push to privatize Social Security and many other human needs benefits, programs, and resources that serve as lifelines for many is at the center of this attack. All but the most privileged households and families are in jeopardy as a result of a wholesale right-wing assault on funding for human needs, including Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, HIV/AIDS research and treatment, public education, affordable housing, and more. The broader conservative agenda of coercive patriarchal marriage promotion plays out in a variety of ways, all of which disproportionately impact poor, immigrant, and people of color communities. The purpose is not only to enforce narrow, heterosexist definitions of marriage and coerce conformity, but also to slash to the bone governmental funding for a wide array of family programs, including childcare, healthcare, and reproductive services and nutrition, and transfer responsibility for financial survival to families themselves." End quote. The authors of Feminism for the 99% point out that capital is no longer implacably opposed to queer and non-cisgender formations. Many large corporations are now willing to permit significant numbers of their employees to live outside heterosexual families. That is, provided they toe the line both at the workplace and at the mall. Thus, we have corporations like Amazon, Dow, Shell, Google, Pfizer, signing on to a statement opposing the recent wave of anti-LGBTQ state legislation, in the belief that queer workers have assimilated into capital and can be conscripted to provide the same social reproductive labor that cis-hetero families do. That conditional corporate acceptance, Eric Maroney suggests in Tempest magazine, facilitates a right-wing vision wherein Western liberal elites are equated with global economic elites. The ruling class is internally divided, then, but not so much that it offers any way out. As Maroney concludes, queer liberation is not just about rolling back the most recent legislative attacks, but also about progressive tax reform, state-funded health care, state-funded child care, and elder care. All these material preconditions are required for the bodily sovereignty of all working people, trans-bodied and cis-bodied people alike. Leftists need to support these goals in a non-reductive way that acknowledges the unique exploitive conditions that trans people face, and we cannot settle for a politics of representation that situates trans identities in the context of corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion campaigns, because that not only fails to meet the material needs of trans people, but also may provide further credibility to the right-wing claim that trans and queer liberation are the conjuring of a wealthy elite. Maroney writes, quote, "The far-right attacks on transgender people stem from profound social anxiety over the crises posed by neoliberal capitalism, which ruthlessly privatizes care and imperils ordinary people's lives. Scapegoating transgender and gender nonconforming people for transgressing essentialist definitions of gendered family values is thus part and parcel of the privatization of social reproduction necessary for neoliberal capitalism to sustain itself. Every fight against exploitation and oppression is thus a fight for trans liberation, and trans liberation struggles are fundamental to anti-capitalist politics." End quote. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
The music you just heard was My Body Politic by Caitlin Carey and Sherlette Ammons from the album We Are Not For Sale, Songs of Protest by the NC Music Love Army, which bookended commentary by Fran Michel on the politics behind attacks on trans lives. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I want to take a moment to thank everyone who has supported KBOO's Winter Drive, All Thrills, No Frills. This is our last week to reach our goal of raising $17,000, and you can help get us there. You can click on the donate button on our website at kboo.fm or on our mobile app, or text KBOO to 44321. Help keep volunteer-powered radio on the air in Portland. To close our show today, we have Left in the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. They take a look at the history of legal protections granted to gun manufacturers in the U.S. and recent lawsuits that challenge those protections. Along the way, they discuss challenges for the left in how to frame the epidemic of gun violence in the U.S.
With off-the-charts rates of gun violence and mass shootings a regular occurrence in the U.S., politicians express their predictable outrage and utter prayers for the victims, offering their own diagnoses of the problem. After the Texas school shooting last summer, Republicans blame woke politicians in the schools, saying liberals made it hard for teachers to discipline students. So, Mike, let's start with your favorite line about mass shootings in America.
It's what The Onion publishes each time there's a mass shooting. No way to prevent this, says Only Nation, where this regularly happens.
Yeah, and that's no joke. No exaggeration, for sure. Let's begin with Oregon. We passed ballot measure 114 in November that tightens gun laws in the state. What would that law do, and what's its status with the courts?
Well, Oregon is split, as is most of America, on this issue. The gun law passed is an excellent provision that would require background checks before you get to buy a weapon, and it would also limit the size of magazines to 10 rounds, which would effectively get rid of the mass murder weapon of choice would be these AR-15s and other weapons that can spew out 16 bullets a second. And you can't aim them at all. They would be invaluable if you were in a trench in Germany and being besieged by hundreds of Frenchmen. You could display bullets in every direction, but they're useless for aiming. They're only good for mass killing. And this would limit those as the use of these kind of weapons. The law is stuck now. Its litigation has ensued both in federal and state court. And the state Supreme Court has unfortunately required that the law remain out of effect until litigation is concluded, which could be many years from now, if ever.
In 2020, the gun control laws in Oregon ranked as the 17th strongest in the country, not an impressive statistic. And the state received a C-plus grade from the Giffords Law Center. What do you make of that?
Well, it's Oregon's rural urban split. You know, there are laws passed, like in Columbia County, which would preclude the enforcement of any law restricting the use of guns. That it's the same sort of philosophy that says that sheriffs in these counties have been designated by the Constitution to be all powerful. The Oregon Courts of Appeal have struck down these laws, say they have no force in effect. You can't, on a county level, declare that a whole range of federal and state laws has no effect in your jurisdiction. But Oregon is fairly evenly split, and the laws reflect that.
So let's turn to the national scene. Joe Biden announced last week that he is ordering the Attorney General Merrick Garland to crack down on gun sellers who break the law.
It's interesting he should do that right after having met with Mexico's president, because Mexico has initiated some really striking litigation against gun manufacturers. Two lawsuits, one of civil action in Massachusetts against Smith & Wesson and others, saying that they've caused massive damage by actively facilitating the unlawful trafficking of their guns to drug cartels and other criminals in Mexico. Now, the classic defense of gun manufacturers is like of a Anheuser-Busch. If somebody sells a Budweiser to an underage kid, you can't hold the beer company liable for that.
But it's the degrees of separation that protects them.
Right. But Mexico has gone a long way toward showing that these people are shipping their weapons to places where they know the likely purchasers, like in Arizona, for example, where Mexico has also brought lawsuit, this time against five gun stores who are merchandising primarily to cartels and their representatives, selling weapons. And Mexico is seeking to get around the huge federal immunity to these lawsuits given to gun manufacturers by Bush Jr. in 2005.
Before turning to the history of the protections extended by the government to gun manufacturers, let's talk a bit more about the Mexico case. I understand it, the case draws parallels with dumping poisonous waste across the border into Mexico, and even using the term trafficking, arms trafficking, brings a certain tone of moral hazard that's different from what the gun manufacturers and dealers have faced.
That's right. It's a very good litigation, and they're also using the concept of corporate complicity as developed in the litigation involving climate change, which went nowhere until people found that Exxon and Shell not only knew all about climate change, but were making significant investment decisions based on the reality of climate change. So that then showed that they were keenly aware of and had lied in various official and unofficial places where they represented that it's all a mystery. It's scientists have different views. We don't know.
So does a Mexico case have that kind of, is it more of a general legal argument, or what do they have in the case that could advance it?
Well, they have been dismissed in the Massachusetts case against Smith and Wesson because of federal immunity. But they have one ground of appeal of that case, which they're taking. And their case in Arizona against five stores is proceeding ahead. And they also made a big deal of that whole issue in the meeting with Biden. So they're driving on many fronts.
So let's talk about the history of lawsuits against gun manufacturers and dealers. Why is that an important strategy for gun control advocacy groups, and what have been some of the legal strategies?
Well, civil litigation is always a good way to check bad behavior. It's the fear of being sued that makes many businesses comport with safety laws. And there were several successful lawsuits aimed at gun manufacturers in the 90s for various practices, reckless practices of merchandising their weaponry. But it's always, it's so much cheaper to buy a few congressmen than it is to change your fundamental way of doing business. So gun manufacturers successfully lobbied to have a law granting them blanket immunity from lawsuits, finally passed in 2005 by the signed into law by President Bush. This was the same time that a 10-year ban on automatic weapons ended. So as of right after 2005, suddenly you have automatic and semi-automatic weapons available, freely available, and you have a ban against any lawsuits against the people who make those weapons.
There's been a shift in recent decades from personal injury claims to public safety and public health arguments. Can you speak to that shift? I think many successful social movements have framed their grievances and arguments in terms of public safety and public health, shifting from kind of individual moral arguments to public safety.
Well, of course, it's a good way to go. I mean, there are effective gun safety groups generally headed by a recognizable figure like James Brady, who was shot, you know, Ronald Reagan's press secretary, and Gaby Giffords. The Giffords is a great website where they keep tabs of every sort of lobbying and litigation effort going on around the issues of gun safety. But they have moved the issue over to public health. I mean, 43,000 people a year are killed by guns in this country. It's way out of proportion to any other comparable, like European country. I mean, it's 10, 20 times as many people proportionally are shot with guns. Toddlers, toddlers' parents, the school kids, the list of people who are victims is staggering. It should be shocking. And yet it's very, very hard to get any traction in the effort to stop this stuff.
There have been these cases of mass litigation against manufacturers of asbestos, Agent Orange, the Dalcon shields, silicon breast implants, tobacco, the big pharma. Do you think the weapons face different kinds of obstacles that have at the center a threat to public safety? Are the issues the gun manufacturers and their own political weapons different from these other industries that have faced, in many cases, successful litigation?
Well, it's become a quasi-religious issue with certain factions in this country. There are Congress people who wear automatic weapon buttons rather than American flags in their suits.
Are they the same ones that have a little fetus on the other lapel?
Probably.
They're protecting.
Probably so. Uh-huh. There have been successful litigation. The most dramatic one is a $73 million settlement Remington made with the victims of the Sandy Hook mass shooting. And that was because they found an exception. There are some exceptions to the blanket immunity having to do with false advertising. And Remington, it turns out, advertised to young men saying, if you want to be a, quote, real man, buy one of our automatic weapons.
Yeah, that was false. That really didn't give their manhood back. Depends on how you define manhood, right?
Yep.
The conservatives defend these automatic weapons with the slippery slope argument. Is that right? How do you explain their defense of these weapons that no rational person could defend?
Well, the slippery slope argument is notorious in legal circles as the one you make when your facts immediately in front of you have no particular value. So you divert the argument away from the case facing you to a non-existent but far worse case, saying that this case, yes, doesn't seem to be so bad, but it is part of a slippery slope. If we do this case, then who knows? Soon enough, we'll be doing this other horrible case. It's a desperate argument resorted to by people who don't have anything compelling in the argument immediately at hand. They try to switch grounds to something that has not yet happened and may never happen.
Conservatives also claim that this is basically Black people killing other Black people, and the problem is the pathology of communities that that will get weapons anyway, and that this is a mental health problem, a poverty problem, and not a weapons problem. And yet about 8 in 10 Black adults say gun violence is a very big problem, by far the largest share of any racial or ethnic group. About 6 in 10 Hispanic adults and only 39% of white adults view gun violence this way. How do you understand the role of racism in gun debates?
Well, it's profound. It's a classic instance of victim blaming and race baiting and race blaming. I mean, I go back to what The Onion said. Yeah, the effort to demonize minority communities should fall flat immediately, because mass shootings are done significantly by white people. They include victims of every race and every age.
Specifically white men, right?
Yes. It's not... This gun violence is far from being confined to ghettos or any specific section of this country. It's endemic everywhere and may burst out in any part of our country at any time. As The Onion said, I'll repeat it, we are the only country, we say that nothing can prevent this. It's in the nature of our communities or in the nature of our mental issues. But every other country in the world has much more severe gun laws and far fewer gun victims.
And that's a classic defense, a corporate defense, right? We're only supplying the demand.
Right. Well, exactly. And so the task of litigation against it is to show that they are creating that demand. They're going to where the demand exists. And the demand for something like a deadly weapon is primarily in the world of, or significantly at least, in the world of drug cartels and criminals.
So, Mike, in closing, if you were representing the left in a court of law, what would be your wise counsel in terms of how to approach this horrific problem of gun violence in America?
I think the Oregon law is very sensible, very reasonable. There's nothing in Oregon's gun laws that would keep people from being able to protect themselves with rifles, which you can actually hit what you aim when you're using them, or handguns. There's nothing in the requirement of background checks, or certainly nothing in the restriction of magazine sizes that would in any way limit your ability to defend your own home.
But this would include having a license, much as we have driver's license. Conservatives aren't arguing we should allow teenagers to drive without driver's licenses, I assume. Well, maybe some of them are.
My wife's father taught her how to drive on Texas roads when she was 13 years old. So there's not a lot of serious deference paid to the department.
Right, but they don't campaign against driver's licenses. But this has, weapons have, I think, also a certain symbolic power as well as material consequences. And I think advancing this idea that this is that of a kind of paranoia, that other people are threats and scary, people from the city are scary. So I think there's a social psychology to this that is important as well.
Well, Jan, that is universal. I think even France and the split between the cities and countries is very common. It's not isolated to Oregon in any way or any other, or this country. I think the real problem is simply one of guns and limiting people's access to them, limiting the possibility of impulsive shootings, of impulsive suicides, of mass murders. This can be done and is done in places that have the same splits ideologically as the U.S., but they're able to agree to limiting access to these deadly weapons.
I remember when I was doing research years back on the public concern about increased suicide rates among service members and veterans, and finding that the most important predictor of suicide is access to a weapon and comfort in using it. And service members and veterans have access to weapons, have been trained to use them, and are comfortable using them. And when they're in a distressed state, are more apt to have means of ending their lives. And I think that was not as apt to be reported in the news releases on higher suicide rates among veterans. So I think I agree. And I think people in the field of suicidology would agree that one way of reducing suicides and family violence is to reduce access to guns.
It's very clear. The Giffords website has shown that there's an easy correlation between gun control and suicides.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow the Oregon case as it languishes in the courts, and also this Mexican case that has this emphasis on trafficking on the U.S. side of the border. Thanks for being with me today.
You're welcome, Jan. It's always a pleasure.
That was Stevie Wonder with his song about the senselessness of gun violence, My Love is With You. Before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss current legal challenges to the gun industry. That's it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Lori Mercier, Fran Michelle, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions. A special thanks to guest Nayana LaFond. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. A brief announcement. If you are disturbed by the ending of the mask requirement in healthcare settings, join the protest today at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Masks are required. Come dressed in the morning color of black and protest the death of public health. On next week's Old Mole, an update on the creative Zapatista revolutionaries of southern Mexico, a look at the golden age of piracy, a report from the movement to build communes in Venezuela, and a Women's History Month reading from Ursula Le Guin. Show your support for the Old Mole Variety Hour and KBOO by becoming a member today. It's the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills Winter Drive. To see our special programming for the drive, you can go to kboo.fm/give, and while you're there, you can click on the donate button. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for tuning in this morning and for supporting your community radio station in Portland, KBOO. I'm going to go out today with more of the song We Rise by Rihanna Giddens. Thanks for listening.
We can't stand apart, 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 apart. Although the miles may separate us, we can't stand apart. Steel tempered in the fire of fear, strength tested in the dark of hate. We had it in us all along. It is and never won't be too late. Sister in my joy, sister in my pain, the woman's burden placed upon us time and time again, 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 again. The woman's burden placed upon us time and time again. Confused, abused, and used.